Are you watching closely? This is Vegas in the 1970s. Look at how it changes from a mob-ruled gambling town to the entertainment capital of the US. Now that is a white tiger. Careful. And these? These are two German cruise ship entertainers. Watch how they turn into the most successful show in Vegas, into the most fabulous queer couple of their time, into the kings of magic. Until one day, in 2003, told you to be careful with that tiger. Cheer up. Red letters on yellow streamers proclaim the title of the show into the New York sky. 1,000 people have taken their seats around the world's largest stage at the Hippodrome Theater. The theme of tonight's show is the circus. That day, January 7th, 1918, the performer is the incredible, the inimitable, the master of magic, Harry Houdini himself. As the paraphernalia of the previous number is wheeled off stage to thunderous applause, Houdini's assistant for the next act makes a remarkable entrance. Her name is Jenny, and she's not wearing any clothes. But that's okay, because Jenny is an elephant. On Houdini's order, Jenny stands on her hindquarters. She's a big girl, easily twice as tall as Houdini, who was 5'5", but that's beside the point. Stagehands roll in a large box, dressed to look like a circus wagon. Houdini pulls off the curtains covering the front and back of the wagon. As you can clearly see, ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing in the box. Animal handlers help Jenny into the wagon. The curtains are closed shut. A bit of misdirection later, Houdini pulls the curtains open again. The box is empty. A 2-ton elephant has just vanished into thin air. 80 years later, Siegfried Fischbacher, the blonde half of Siegfried and Roy, would joke that the hard part isn't disappearing the elephant, it's reappearing, which he would do on stage 12 times a week for nearly 2 decades with a much bigger elephant, complete with clothes on the elephant, and with Roy, Siegfried's partner, standing on its head. This is magic, the performing art of magic, illusionism. But in the 1960s, magic on stage is as dead as King Tut's mummy. Post-war youth wants to live and love and dance. They want nightclubs and movies and road trips, not senior citizens pulling rabbits out of hats. And yet, in the mid-70s, magic makes quite the comeback. Every hotel in Vegas wants their show. Illusionists get their names in lights on marquees. They sell more tickets than Elvis. How did this happen? Watch closely. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, and Sluz the Shoggoth, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. It's 1957, as the Bremen, a German cruise ship, is sailing the North Atlantic. Siegfried Fischbacher is a steward by day. At night, he puts on a magic show. Two magic shows, really. One for the second-class passengers and one for first-class. It's all doves and rabbits and kerchiefs, but Siegfried's chiseled cheekbones and baby blue eyes are doing wonders for the crowd. Siegfried is 18 years old, and magic is his life. He started working at age 14 in a carpet factory. Anything to escape a conservative Bavarian family, particularly his alcoholic, violent dad, who, as Siegfried puts it, brought the war home with him. From childhood, Siegfried is mesmerized by magic. he buys, or possibly steals, a book and teaches himself tricks. When he shows his mother the book, she hits him like she never hit him before. In this Catholic home, magic is blasphemy. When he's 14, Siegfried puts on a show for the goat farmers in his area. In the candlelit barn, things are going smoothly until the climax. Siegfried tries to disappear a goat. Most of the goat obliges, but to quote Siegfried, "I tried and tried, but could not vanish the tail." The farmers think it's hilarious. Siegfried gives up on vanishing large animals. For the time being, Siegfried spends his teenage years as a waiter in various hotels across Europe. At night, he performs and works on new tricks. He trains himself to swallow 20 razor blades on a string. He doesn't know that there's a trick. Magicians don't actually swallow blades, so he finds a way to do it for real. Magic doesn't pay the bills. Could it ever? Siegfried gets a degree in hospitality and boards the T.S. Bremen. The captain likes him, his half-hour magic shows are popular, but Siegfried gets bored easily. On his second season aboard, he wants to improve. More tricks, more intricate, faster. But there's only one of him to coordinate the illusions, the banter, the lights, the music, so he enrolls the help of a bellboy, a kid with dark brown hair and a smile that could melt an iceberg. Roy, his real name, Uwe Horn, is 4 years Siegfried's junior. He grew up in Nordenham, just across the river from the major city of Bremen, the namesake of the ship, at the other end of Germany from Siegfried, but in similar circumstances. Roy's life changes when he meets a friend of his mom's, whom he calls Uncle Emil. Emil is the managing director of the Sparkasse in Bremen, a savings and loan bank. After the war, this bank is a powerful force in rebuilding the country. So Emil gets a seat on the board of just about every institution in the city, including the Bremen Zoo. Thanks to Emil, Roy visits the zoo every day. Soon the teenager is allowed to do menial work with the animals. That's when he develops a special relationship with a 2-year-old cheetah named Chico. In Roy's words, "I learned to take care of him. I scrubbed his quarters, I brushed his coat, I fed him. Eventually he allowed me to put a collar and leash on him and take him out for walks." Roy leaves home at age 13. 1 year later, he signs on as a bellboy on the Bremen. Magic is not really on his radar when the ship's illusionist asks for his help, but sure, it can't be as boring as carrying suitcases. After their first show, Siegfried buys him a beer, asks how he liked the show. Roy's answer? Meh, the magic was predictable. Years later, Roy will say that in fact, he'd enjoyed the show a lot, but he didn't tell Siegfried because he had a plan. How would Siegfried like to disappear something bigger? Way bigger. Like a cheetah. Back home, Roy faces an impossible situation. The zoo gave him Chico the cheetah outright, but on the condition that Roy would take care of him. Chico is the only reason Roy comes home when the ship sails in. If he could bring the cheetah on board, Roy's family would lose their grip on him. The next cruise season starts, and Roy carries on board a rather bulky laundry bag. He only lets the cat out of the bag once they're so far out at sea they can't turn back. Then he calls on Siegfried. The magician walks in, closes the door. Roy opens the laundry bag, and Siegfried takes a giant leap backwards. He didn't really believe this kid when he'd said he had a pet cheetah. Now there's a wild animal on board, and they're both gonna get fired. Roy placates him. If the audience likes the show, it'll be fine. So Siegfried designs the grand finale around Chico. On stage, Roy enters a large box. The box gets covered by a cloth. Siegfried lifts the cloth. He reveals an empty box and the wild cat sitting atop the box, secured by a chain, presumably. Dazzled by the lights and the crowd and the applause, Chico leaps off the stage and across the room. Roy, mesmerized by it all, has dropped the chain. He has no choice but to follow his animal. They ascend the grand staircase. At the top of the stairs, like a seasoned pro, Chico turns around and faces the audience. Standing ovation. There's just one person in the audience who doesn't love it. The ship's captain. They're fired. Except, in the audience that night were the owner of the shipping company that owns the Bremen, and his wife. Best show they've seen on any ship, they say. How would the duo like to perform on their Caribbean ships? And so they do. Until 1964. Then, they leave cruise ships for a tour in Germany. Everyone tells them they're crazy to try and headline a major tour with a full magic show, Illusionists perform in vaudeville halls. Those theaters are closing to make room for the new trend, nightclubs. But nightclubs don't offer the elevated stages that an illusionist relies heavily upon. The magician performs in the middle of an audience, seating at tables. And a lot of these clubs are glorified striptease joints. Performing with wild animals so close to the audience might prove tricky. And the audience isn't rising up to the idea of watching two fully dressed guys for half an hour. The duo has to make do with a tiny dance floor for a stage. No trapdoors, no stagehands or ship's carpenters, no backstage to make spectacular entrances and exits. They go on the road, meaning they have to sleep somewhere, and most bed and breakfast owners are wary of potential customers holding a cheetah on a leash. One saving grace, though, they have no competition. Magic as a performing art is, for all intents and purposes, dead. The only surviving illusionists are big names attached to first-rate circuses. If there are young magicians anywhere in Germany, they are not suicidal enough to perform in strip joints. Siegfried and Roy have the whole circuit to themselves. They're starving, because the pay is low and the cheetah eats sirloin, but they get the gigs. Then it's Switzerland. More strip clubs and cramped joints. But in Lausanne, Mrs. Posch, the cabaret owner, is about to leave for Monte Carlo. She loves their act. She recommends them to the organizers of the Red Cross Gala in Monte Carlo. Standing at the easternmost point of the French Riviera, Monte Carlo at the time wasn't the tacky Dubai on the Mediterranean it's become. It had no skyscrapers. What it had was glamour. The capital and only city of the Principality of Monaco, one of the smallest independent countries in the world, and for all intents and purposes, a French territory, Monte Carlo was a beautiful place for beautiful people. Back in 1956, Prince Rainier of Monaco had married Hollywood actress Grace Kelly. Every summer, you had movie stars and music idols and heads of state flocking to the area for the gorgeous coastline, the enchanted sunsets, the delicious foods, and increasingly, the entertainment. The Red Cross Gala was the peak of the season, a night of what the world stage did best. A word of warning, though. The only source we have Siegfried and Roy's lives until they land in Vegas is their authorized biography, Mastering the Impossible, written by Annette Tappert and published in 1992. It reads like a fairy tale. Some facts are just plain false, others are painted in pretty colors. Sleight of hand and misdirection abound. A grain of salt is in order. Anyway, on the evening of October 5th, 1966, in Monte Carlo, Siegfried and partner, as they were billed back then, performed to the star-studded audience. Elizabeth Taylor, Cary Grant, Maria Callas, men in white tie and dress uniforms, women in jewels and golden saris. While Roy is so excited he could burst, Siegfried is sick with stage fright and the stomach ulcers that will pester him all his life. But their 15-minute performance is a triumph. As they're about to conclude, Chico the Cheetah takes a beat center stage and makes his exit, calmly, through the audience, purring all the way. The way Siegfried tells it, Chico is running toward the kitchens. Roy is running after Chico. Siegfried is running after Roy to chew his head off, certain that Chico's escapade just cost them their career. And running after Siegfried is a man whose name will be unfamiliar to most, but the others will jump clear off their couches. Daniel Maruani. If ever there was a dynasty of star makers in the French music business, that was the Maruanis. They were agents, publishers, and theater owners. They managed the biggest names like Josephine Baker, Edith Piaf, and Louis Mariano, and Charles Aznavour. Three generations of Maruanis reigned over the French stage from the 1920s to the end of the 20th century. So, in 1966, if Daniel Maruani was running after you, you'd want to stop. Looking back, both Siegfried and Roy would call that night their big break. Maruani books the duo for a series of shows, first in Nice at the lavish Hotel Negresco, then in Madrid. In Madrid, they are approached by a representative of the Folies Bergères, a music hall in Paris, famous for its clothing-challenged dancers. The man needs an act for his three-month review at the Tropicana in Las Vegas. Siegfried and Roy find themselves in the middle of a tug-of-war between two French venues. The Folies, less high-end, offers to book them a review at the Tropicana in Vegas, and the much more prestigious Lido de Paris offers to book them there. Siegfried has been dreaming of playing at the Lido for years. The duo drives all night from Madrid to Paris. They visit both places, attend both shows, meet both owners. As they tell it, it's all in the meetings.
The Lido's negotiating tactic is to put them down. The Germans are not tall enough. Their show is corny. Using animals would require expensive construction. The Lido puts down Vegas as well. It makes sense. If the magicians opted to go straight to Vegas, the Paris Theater wouldn't get their 10% cut. They go straight to Vegas. What can Vegas be like? The year is 1970. There's no internet. Even color TV is not that common. Roy says he pictures an almost tropical place with a touch of the Arabian Nights. In keeping with the vision, he lands with two cheetahs and a few pink flamingos. Siegfried hates the place on sight. No trees, no birds, no mountains, a landscape of tan and rust, with an endless string of casinos and slot machines. To me, it was Death Valley, he writes. Where were my bistros, my sidewalk cafes? Siegfried speaks spotty English, and he doesn't have a driver's license. In an American Sunbelt city, that limits your mobility more than not having any limbs. And Roy? Ever the optimistic, life-loving, carefree half of the duo, Roy takes to Vegas like a rabbit to a hat. He hires a silver Studebaker with a red interior, for the cheetahs. He rents Errol Flynn's old mansion, with a pond that leaks. The water bill amounts to his weekly earnings at the Tropicana. They show up at the Tropicana with their flamingos. The owner, Mr. Hustles, has no idea who they are. He has no say in the act the Follies hire for their review. Magicians, you say? Mr. Hustles warns them. Boys, I have to tell you, magic don't work in this town. He might be right. Their first night is a fiasco. At the climax, Chico is meant to jump atop the substitution box. The conductor, Ray Sinatra, Frank's second cousin, calls for a drum roll. A spotlight focuses on Chico. Startled, Chico jumps into the orchestra pit. Mid-flight, he takes off Sinatra's toupee and lands on the grand piano. Six of the 18 musicians flee in panic. The audience rushes to the pit to check out the cheetah, who's lying in splendor on the white lacquered baby grand. Undeterred, Sinatra conducts what's left of the orchestra to a final flourish. Incredibly, Siegfried and Roy are not fired. They work to pack as much magic in their 12 minutes as humanly possible, so they act fast. Magicians usually take their time, building up to the final revelation. Not these kids. They add another cheetah. At long last, Roy, who spent the past 7 years listening to the final applause lying flat against the double bottom of the substitution trunk while Chico took a bow, can get his share of the literal spotlight. After 3 months in Vegas, they're off to the Lido in Paris. The 3-year contract was Siegfried's dream, but they're not happy. The management is pinching pennies, so they can't perform the improvements they developed in Vegas. No second cheetah, no showgirl. For them, Paris is a step backwards. Roy returns to the trunk's double bottom. But something has clicked. Roy wants to be seen. He takes on a stage persona at the complete opposite of Siegfried's classical magician in a tux and starched white shirt. He grows his hair down to his shoulders. He wears very tight pants, leather boots, and a shirt open to the waist, revealing gold chains around his neck. The 70s, baby. Lido wants them back in Vegas to perform in the review at the Stardust. Roy is all systems go. Siegfried would rather lock himself up in the substitution trunk. He's likely burned out after years of doing 2 shows a night, 7 days a week. Help comes in the shape of a Puerto Rican casino. Would they like a relaxed schedule, 1 show per night, days off, and everything nice Puerto Rico has to offer? You bet your hat they would. In Puerto Rico, they have 3 months of unbridled fun and sun and sea and, well, a tiger. One of their cheetahs gets sick, so Roy adopts Sara, a Siberian tiger. Roy has zero training in animal handling. Luckily, Sara displays a sweet personality. Off to Vegas she goes. The feline family expands, and Roy wants Siegfried to use it. They've been appearing big cats for 10 years now. How could they disappear them? They work together for 6 months, but can't find a solution that works with their surroundings at the Stardust. Then Siegfried goes on vacation in Hawaii. When he comes back, he knows. He has actually invented a new way of disappearing large objects. I'm not taking his word for it. The whole industry recognizes it. The duo starts garnering awards. They roll up several illusions into one, never allowing one number to exceed 3 minutes. The speed and combination of illusions becomes as much their trademark as the cats. We had no choice but to walk fast and move with style, Siegfried writes. In 1973, as their 3-year contract at the Stardust comes to an end, they're showered with offers. More Vegas casinos. A Broadway show. but they go for what's on paper the least glamorous of them all, a one-year stint at the Americana Hotel in Puerto Rico. They know more options will be available at the end of it. In Puerto Rico, far from the eyes of the global media, they introduce new animals. A lion, because they've just accepted to follow up with 3 months at the MGM Grand, and that calls for a lion, doesn't it? Also, a jaguar, and a black panther named Sabu. Sabu, Roy writes, is extremely demanding of my attention. If I don't greet him first in the morning, he ignores me all day. Whenever I'm on vacation, he refuses to eat if I don't telephone him daily. One evening, Roy throws a party for the show's cast at his Puerto Rican villa in Isla Verde. Sabu the Black Panther is enjoying the cool marble floors in Roy's room and relaxing on Roy's waterbed. The 70s, baby. Roy locks him up for the duration of the party. After a few glasses of bubbly, water comes cascading down the main staircase. Do you have a leak? A dancer asks. Roy and Siegfried look at one another in panic. Sabu. Sabu resented not being invited to the party. Sabu was displeased. Sabu took his claws to the waterbed. When they had left Las Vegas for Puerto Rico, the MGM Grand was just a parking lot. 1 year later, it's a gigantic hotel with the ultimate in luxuries and a show priced at $10 million, a record for the time. The MGM Grand show is a roaring success. Now other hotel owners want in on the action, and other magicians want a piece of the pie. It is during this time in 1974 that magic starts to flourish in every Vegas hotel. Magic isn't stodgy anymore. These German boys have found a way to make it new, but magic shows in general are still stuck in the days of tailcoats, top hats, and post-Spanish flu spiritualism. Magic overall isn't new again. Siegfried and Roy are what's new. Magicians start forming duos. One dyes their hair blonde, the other dark brown. They copy the looks, one dude in a tux, the other in a Playboy shirt. Some magicians even bring their own tiger to the auditions. It would be funny if they didn't also break into Siegfried and Roy's prop room with a tape measure to figure out how their illusions worked. A pair of Hungarian brothers bribe Siegfried's prop builders to get their secrets. The Siegfried and Roy brand of magic sets Vegas on fire, but there's only so much our boys can take. Now it's 1977, and the duo is as good as finished. They hate their work, their life, their theater, and they're starting to resent one another. Siegfried self-medicates with Valium, gets hooked, takes a two-week break to get straightened up. Then one night in the audience, a 27-year-old music manager accompanies his mom to the greatest show in town.
His name is Bernie Uman. He's already made quite a name for himself in music. He can't tell a magic trick from a showgirl's bikini, but showbiz is showbiz, and as soon as Bernie sees them on stage, he immediately knows. He will be their manager. Bernie has been approached by the Stardust to boost their audience. They never managed to fill more than half of the 1,140 seats. Bernie says it's simple, get Siegfried and Roy. He negotiates terms with the Stardust. Great, now all he has to do is get the magicians on board. They've never heard of him. He walks in through the stage door, waits for them in their dressing room at the Grand. They call security. He pleads. Security throws him out. He waits at the casino's oyster bar. He pleads again. And this time they listen. In 24 hours, they sign a contract, and everybody's life gets strapped to a rocket. At long last, the Stardust offers the duo what they always wanted, their name in lights on the marquee, facilities for the animals, a dressing room that's an actual apartment in the hotel, sceneries and backdrops, and Bashful, a 27-year-old elephant. Opening night is blissful. 35 minutes of magic, except for a tiny bump. Siegfried vanishes Leo the lion and reappears him inside his locked cage. Because the audience would often think the lion was fake, Siegfried makes a few aggressive gestures at the lion to get him to react. But that night, on the new stage, Leo is stunned. Siegfried amps up the karate. Still no reaction. And then, in an instant, Leo pounces and bites off a huge chunk of Siegfried's arm. 38 stitches and a shot of Novocaine later, and they're on to their second show of the night. The show must go on. Siegfried spins the lion's cage around, some 900 pounds of metal and big cat, and his stitches burst. By the final curtain, he's soaked in blood. But the show does go on. For that show, the duo develops an illusion Roy's been thinking about for years. It should go like this. Sara the Siberian tiger leaps onto a glowing, oversized mirror ball. Tiger and ball rise above the stage and disappear in the rafters. That's all well and good, except that When the ball starts to rise in rehearsals, Sarah jumps off. She doesn't care for heights. Roy doesn't either, but he has no choice. To placate Sarah, he must ride the mirror ball with her. Now, the tiger rises high, 30 feet, 10 meters above the stage, sitting on a swiveling orb that's throwing slivers of light as it goes, with Roy standing astride her. You can call the antics campy, the costumes passé, and the working with cats just plain wrong by today's standards, but that image is simply incredible. The show is a resounding success, and that doesn't go unnoticed. They take part in a Barnum & Bailey TV special. That's how they meet the other most important person in their business lives. Irvin Feld is a producer with a golden touch. He discovered the crooner Paul Anka, pushed Sinatra to play big arenas. He booked Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers and an up-and-coming British band called the Beatles. But Feld doesn't stop at music. Back in 1967, he buys the Barnum & Bailey Circus for $8 million. The contract is signed in the middle of Rome's Colosseum, and the amount paid for in gold. You can't make this stuff up. In 1971, Feld sells Barnum to Mattel for $50 million. Then he buys it back for $35 million. But there's one place in show business Feld still can't touch, and that's Las Vegas. The Germans and their cats are his golden ticket. He devises a new strategy for the duo. At that point, Siegfried and Roy are still doing a 35-minute stint as part of a bigger show. Feld convinces them they're ready for greater things. And the stardust, he says, isn't big enough for the both of them. The business team, now composed of producer Irvin Feld, his son Kenneth, and manager Bernie Eumann, negotiates with a bigger casino, the Frontier. In 1979, they get their own NBC specials, and now it's no holds barred. Crocodiles, penguins, kangaroos, a flock of flamingos, motorbikes and jeeps disappearing left and right, they get to be the first magicians to use lasers on stage. For good measure, they sing and dance with a line of showgirls. Roy calls that last bit the greatest illusion of all. They can't dance to save their lives, but the fun is infectious. The theater at the Frontier is packed nightly. Yet when Siegfried and Roy first opened at the Frontier, word on the street was that they wouldn't last a week. 1 hour and 40 minutes of magic? A magic show as long as my episode about David Woodard? Who wants to watch that? It's never been done in Vegas. For good reason, presumably, right? That would be ignoring a major trend. The city was changing. When our German duo made landfall in 1967, Vegas was a gambling town, pure and simple. Patrons came to watch a show hungover, having just lost money on the tables, or having just gotten married and divorced, or suffering from jet lag. Either way, their mind was elsewhere. So bring on the girls, sing a few songs, make a few jokes, and that's your show. Not much more than an interlude between bouts of gambling. But in the 80s, Vegas made a deliberate push to evolve into a much classier tourist destination. The opening of the Convention Center in 1981 brought in a much more international crowd, and one that isn't exclusively interested in gambling. Not relying on language goes a long way in accounting for the duo's success in Vegas. Up until then, a Vegas show was either showgirls or singers, singers who sang in English. For sure, you don't need to speak English to appreciate Elvis, but there were never enough Elvises to go around. Sure, Sinatra is still killing it at the Caesar's Palace and the Golden Nugget, but Sinatra's show is famous for its very long, very spoken breaks. And you can't bring your wife or kids to the Lido or the Feliz, where the entire stage wardrobe would hardly cover Houdini's elephant. Siegfried and Roy are the only act in town whole families of non-English speakers can enjoy. And that's a lot of folks, if you consider that during their time at the Frontier, they sell 700,000 tickets a year. The convention crowd is also much younger. Sinatra and his Rat Pack are not necessarily their first pick. They want fun and modern and fast. Magic may be a thing of the past, but Siegfried and Roy's offering is definitely of its time. Today, you can watch a Siegfried and Roy show and think it's the most 80s thing of all time, but it was already the most 80s thing of all time in the 70s. Thanks to Irvin Feld, they have their pick of the Barnum Act. They choose the King Charles troupe. Forget British royalty, these are a diverse team of kids from tough neighborhoods playing basketball on unicycles. In no time, they're also breakdancing and rapping. And two black kids are leading a white showgirl down the grand staircase. Hotel bosses are livid. You can't do that in Vegas. Yes, you can. But that's another old-timey thing, though. They still feature showgirls. Bare-breasted showgirls, by any other name on Wikipedia, are very much a Vegas staple. Neither magician is particularly keen on female nudity on stage, and they hate turning away the increasing number of under 21s who show up asking for tickets. They raise the point with Irvin Feld. So on Fridays, they schedule a family show, with the girls covered. That's a huge nail in the coffin of old Vegas. The hotel bosses turn from livid to apoplectic, but the family show sells, months in advance, and grows from once to three times weekly. And now, boys, girls, durians, dolls, and big cats of all ages, is the time for me to tell you the story of the Maharaja of Rewa, a hidden gem in the state of Madhya Pradesh. Located 500 miles or 850 kilometers from Delhi, the city of Rewa was famous in the days of the British Raj for its classical music, sweet mangoes, charming waterfalls, and the fairy tale palace where the Maharaja lived. And on the Maharaja's coat of arms pounced a mythical creature, a white tiger. The Maharaja went on long hunts. Where other heroes obsessed with white whales, he single-mindedly focused on finding a white tiger. His full name was His Honor Samrajya Mahajidharya Bandresh Sri Maharaja Martan Singh Judeo Bahadur. Most of this is honorific. His first name was Martand, last name Singh. But if you called him that, you'd probably get thrown to the tigers. In old British India, Rewa was one of the princely states. Places in India, ranging from small towns to whole provinces, where a ceremonial monarch still officially ruled in exchange for tolerating the British Empire's control over the rest of the country. When independence loomed after World War II, many of the hundreds of Rajas, Nawabs, and Nizams who led the princely states didn't want to see the British leave India, because independence would mean surrendering their crowns to the Prime Minister of the new Republic of India. Some of them were invaded and overthrown by the Indian military as soon as the British left. Most were convinced to give up their powers, which had always been in name only anyway, in exchange for annual payments from the Indian government, called privy purses. The Rajas retained their wealth and their palaces, and unofficially, their titles. Rewa was never one of the most important princely states, but was never the bottom of the barrel either. They were a salute state, meaning that when British diplomats visited, they had to present the Maharaja with a 15-gun salute. The number of guns the British used to salute the leaders of princely states was the system they used to rank the states. The biggest and most powerful got 21 gun salutes, indicating the British saw them as full independent countries. Others got 19 gun salutes, others no salute at all. 15 was about the middle of the pack. Long story short, in 1951, the Maharaja of Rewa found what he'd quested for since the day he could ride an elephant, a white tiger. He named him Mohan, the Fascinating. After years of breeding, in 1958, Mohan sired a couple of white cubs with chocolate stripes. The Maharaja had cracked the code and started what we call today a breeding program. He turned the woods around his palace into a tiger reserve, where the big cats roamed free. Some say they even had the run of the palace and its 120 rooms. But the Maharaja loved white tigers too much. He was brokenhearted when Mohan the Fascinating passed away. And when Mohan's cub, Virat, died in 1972, it was just unbearable. It didn't help that the Indian government abolished privy purses in 1971. Now, the man still locally known as the Maharaja was truly just a private citizen. The Maharaja put an end to his tiger program. He closed down the reserve. He gifted a few white cats to the zoos abroad. One of them went to Washington, D.C. With a caveat, though. They could breed white tigers, but never ever sell one to a private individual. Vegas, 1982. Watching tigers appearing and floating on stage at the frontier is the Maharaja's nephew. He helms animal conservation in the government of Indira Gandhi. He sees Roy treating big cats like so many teddy bears. But what strikes him most is what he doesn't see. No cages, no chains, no whips. What's going on here? This gentleman, who calls himself the Maharaja of Vadodara, is introduced to Roy's nonviolent methods. What the entertainer calls affection conditioning. Not to be confused with affective conditioning, which is an association technique used in advertising to make you feel like James Bond when you drive a particular brand of car. Roy's affection conditioning is about caring for the cubs like their mothers would, co-sleeping with them until the age of one, feeding them bottles, playing with them, giving them treats daily. One of the TV specials features jaw-dropping footage of Roy crouching on the back of a galloping snow-white tiger, riding her like a fluffy horse across his front lawn, And there's no way the tiger would have stood for a second of that if she didn't have fun too, right? Of course, there's a whole side we'll never know about. Teaching large wild beasts tricks, cues, and release reflexes can't be done with treats alone. No professional animal trainer would come on stage with big cats and zero protection. Roy would. Maybe there's a good reason for that. But at the time, the Maharaja is adamant. These are the guys he needs to expand his uncle's vision of bringing white tigers to the world. Together, they set up a breeding program. They negotiate with the Cincinnati Zoo. Cincinnati has borrowed the white tiger from DC and was successfully breeding white cats. After months of negotiations, Cincinnati agrees that the next two white cubs will go to Siegfried and Roy. But when the litter is born, Roy has the shock of his life. One of the cubs is Snow White, not a stripe in sight. The zoo deems her of no value to the breeding program. They already have two Snow White females, and they never gave birth. Snow White seemed to be sterile. But to Roy, this is his dream animal, his white whale. He leaves Cincinnati with two striped white cubs and a snowball. Now, just so we're clear, white tigers, with or without stripes, are not a separate species. They are Bengal tigers, Panthera tigris tigris. They are not albino, as you can tell from their glacier blue eyes. Albino animals have pink eyes. Instead, they carry a recessive gene, allele SLC54A2, that fails to turn their fur orange. It's pretty, but as far as camouflaging them in the jungle, it's an epic fail, which probably explains why they're so rare in the wild. They don't last very long. They are a captivity curiosity. And because every single white tiger in captivity today descends from Mohan the Fascinating, they suffer from a host of health issues, spinal deformities, a cleft palate, immune deficiencies, renal problems, premature death. White tigers are not an endangered species. Tigers are. White tigers are a genetic accident, multiplied and amplified through inbreeding.
The arrival of the white cubs profoundly changes Roy. He picks up meditation with Sitara, the snow white tiger, at his feet on his bed. Big cats roam free all over the jungle palace, the lavishly decorated mansion, and 2-acre grounds where Siegfried and Roy live. The duo shares the house. Obviously, we'll come back to that.
At the frontier, Roy designs a white tiger habitat. The enclosure is entirely white, in the hope of reminding the tigers of their ancestors' home in the Himalayan foothills. It comprises pools, waterfalls, and palm trees. The white cubs grow up. In 1986, Roy succeeds where the Cincinnati Zoo failed. Sitara is the first snow white tiger to give birth in captivity. Mother and cubs ride to the enclosure in Greta Garbo's vintage Rolls Royce. But in 1986, Las Vegas is yesterday's news. What happened? Rock and roll is what happened. Like so many other things, in the 80s, rock concerts got big. They gave one-night performances in every city they stop at, their big shows, complete with thunderous sound systems and lighting effects, and a high ticket price. Country music legend Kenny Rogers, a Vegas staple, makes twice as much on tour, $100,000 per night, as he would by playing in Vegas. Most hotel bosses see the trend, but they hold on to the old formula. Not Steve Wynn. 13 years earlier, Steve Wynn turned the Golden Nugget from a stale old dive into a luxury venue where Sinatra performed. Now, he's bought the last undeveloped lot on the Vegas Strip. The architects are at work, so of course, he's talking to Siegfried and Roy. They've got the biggest show in town. Actually, by this point, they're the biggest act in the history of Vegas by gross profit. They sometimes turn away as many as 3,000 people per night. Steve Wynn makes them the offer of a lifetime. In his future hotel, the Mirage, he will build a theater to their specification. He'll include a huge space for all the animals backstage, as well as a menagerie and dedicated tiger habitat open to visitors. The magicians will get to design their show with zero interference from him. The money isn't bad either. $57.5 million for 5 years. Deal. In the winter of 1990, after modeling for a line of ski wear bearing their name, Siegfried and Roy would report for work at the newly built Mirage Hotel and Casino. But in the meantime, they have plenty to do. In 1987, they arranged to donate two white tigers to a German zoo. To make the most of the bonkers logistics involved in flying halfway around the world with tigers, they schedule several stops along the way. Landing in New York City, the Tigers climb into a yellow van. Siegfried and Roy board a white limousine bearing their crest, I shit you not, and off they go to the CBS studios to appear in the morning program. A live show. On the set, they install a huge white rock and some palm trees. The magicians dress in cowboy attire. Then, they wait for the Tigers. 10 minutes to air. Where are the Tigers? Opposite the CBS offices, the animal handlers had arrived early, so they'd gone for a cup of coffee, watching the yellow van through the window. Imagine their horror when the van started to move. They storm out and chase the van for a few blocks. In vain. So they burst into the closest police precinct. New York's finest have seen a lot in their line of duty, but our Tigers just got stolen, must have been a new one. When a frantic Roy gets the chief of police on the phone, the man replies, "I've gotta hang up now. I gotta feed my pink elephants." So, Bernie Human works the phones. Ed Koch, the mayor of New York, gets involved. The police release a bolo, be on the lookout, notice for the van. And now the CBS show is on, live. Roy makes a heartbroken appeal. It's picked up by 28 subsidiaries and most local radio stations. Pretty much the whole of Manhattan is looking for the yellow van. Speculations are running rampant. Could this be a publicity stunt? They're magicians, after all. Isn't their shtick precisely to make tigers disappear? Or could it be a kidnapping? Days earlier, Steve Wynn had publicized the 8-figure deal, and the Tigers had posed for Van Cleef and Arpels, the luxury jewelers, drenched in diamonds and sapphires. Was there a ransom note coming? Far from the TV studios and the jewelry stores, up in the Bronx, on 180th Street, a woman reports an illegally parked van. It's yellow, and the noises it makes are strange, even for New York. Two cops take pity on Siegfried and Roy. Their unmarked beat-up sedan tears through red lights and one-way streets to get up there and check on their friend. The Tigers are safe and sound. They are reunited with the magicians, who will swear to their dying day that this was never a hoax. If that's the case, spare a thought for the goons who stole a shiny yellow van thinking they'd made payday, heard hissing and growling noises in the back, and turned around. Now that the whole family is together again, they can leave. While waiting for their theater to be built at the Mirage, they go on a 10-month tour of Japan. Fuji Television builds a 3,600-seat mobile theater. It opens in Ginza, a business district of Tokyo. There were much bigger portable stages at the time. Teresa Tang, a Taiwanese singer whose recognition in the Chinese cultural sphere is like Michael Jackson plus Taylor Swift plus the Beatles, had a stage long enough to accommodate an actual aircraft carrier. But it didn't host a tiger habitat with a swimming pool or a riding area for Roy's Andalusian stallion, or TV sets for the animals inside their enclosures, just in case the elephant got bored. Because of course they brought their elephant along. During their stay in Japan, Siegfried and Roy play for 1.5 million spectators and perform in 4 TV specials, grossing $55 million. Then they travel to Europe, Rome, to meet the Pope, with Siegfried's sister, who is an actual nun. Now, Siegfried longs for some theater and convinces Roy to go to London. There, they attend a performance of Time, a musical starring the aging British middle-of-the-road pop star Cliff Richard. It's a revelation. The outer space sets, with the 15-foot-high holograms and the celestial beings floating around, are just what they want for their show. They hunt down the set designer, a man named John Napier. Napier is so much more than just a set designer. He's the most wanted director in the West End and on Broadway both. He directed Les Miserables and Starlight Express, the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical where the characters represent trains and the actors perform on roller skates. Did you know that exists? And, of course, Cats. Don't get cocky. Thanks to him, the upcoming show at the Mirage takes a quantum leap. It's not a string of magic tricks anymore. It's a full-on show with a storyline, well-timed dance breaks, 75 tons of set pieces and 300 miles of cable. There is a massive ring of fire inside which Roy levitates, and a spaceship-like orb hosting half a dozen white tigers. There's also a 6-story-high hydraulic dragon to unite the theme of good versus evil. Napier ropes in top talent from Les Mis, The Phantom of the Opera, and the Royal Shakespeare Company. The result? A mixture of rock and roll, P.T. Barnum, Wagner's operas, and Japanese sci-fi. And the result of that is that you open late. They miss the New Year's Eve opening night by a month. Yet it only gives Siegfried and Roy 4 weeks of full rehearsals. Because they perform to taped music, the show needs to be exactly on cue. And go tell that to your elephant. Or to your tiger, that's trying to make a grand exit in midair, through a computerized set piece, and the door doesn't always open. Throughout the weeks of rehearsal, the hydraulic dragon proves to be the stuff of nightmare. It drops Roy from a height of 50 feet. It sends him flying into a wall, breaking a foot and a few ribs. At some point, the dragon has feet, and his boots are made for walking, so the great juggernaut walks right off the stage and barges into the casino. When the show finally opens, to an original song written for them by Michael Jackson, Napier hides his head in his hands, bracing for the inevitable. Backstage, Steve Wynn, who owns the Mirage, producer Irvin Feld and manager Bernie Human are sweating bullets. But the hydraulic dragon behaves. The elephant is on cue. The tigers fly, the showgirls get sawed. Vegas just got modern, and every rabbit in a top hat gets old. That night, and every night for 13 years, the show runs smoothly enough that if anything was amiss, you couldn't tell. That is, until Roy's 59th birthday. The date is October 3rd, 2003, and at 7:30, the show starts right on time. In between spectacular magic tricks at breakneck speed, John Napier devised a few slower beats. 1,500 people are now watching one of those quieter moments. Roy is parading one of his white tigers, an adult male named Manticore, on a simple leash. On cue, Manticore rises on his hind legs to meet Roy face to face, catching a well-hidden treat as he goes. This bit is called the rapport act. What Roy is demonstrating here is his personal flavor of animal handling. Roy is very comfortable with Manticore. He claims to have assisted in his difficult birth back in 1996. Manticore was raised like all of Roy's tigers, at the Jungle Palace with affection conditioning. At the Mirage, there is nothing to separate the tiger from the audience. No fence, no chain, no plexiglass wall. The audience, of course, loves this. Patrons pay extra to sit next to the stage, because sometimes, when new cubs are born to Roy's tigers, he lets audience members take them in their arms. Yes, he does that. They're reaching the end of the promenade, and Roy needs to do something trainers call resetting. Walk the animal in a short, full circle to get him ready for what's next. Maybe Roy is less attentive than usual when he does the resetting. The night before, he celebrated his birthday. A huge party. 500 guests. Celebs rubbing shoulders with the show's cast and crew. There were tigers on the birthday cakes. Tigers in ice sculptures. Maybe he's a little hungover. Maybe he's a bit too trusting of Manticore. Or maybe none of these things are true, and Manticore just suddenly remembers he's a tiger. And snaps. Roy sees it. He sees it in Manticore's eye, the sparkle of rebellion. Witnesses report Roy giving Manticore a tap on the nose with his mic. That's a common trick to stop spicy cats, of all sizes, before they move to do something wild. Too little. Too late. The next second, Roy drops to the floor like a ragdoll, and Manticore, clenching Roy's neck firmly in his jaws, is dragging him off stage. There is so much blood. A stagehand yells, "Cat loose!" The crew radio crackles. "He's got Roy!" The audience is silent. Nobody moves. Is this part of the show? It takes two announcements on the PA system for the audience to start leaving their seats. Meanwhile, backstage, Curtis Rao is a stagehand. He hears the panicked call on the radio. He rushes in, just in time to see Manticore dragging Roy to the substitution box. Curtis realizes that if Manticore manages to pull the body fully inside the box, like he would a prey into his lair, there would be no saving Roy. So Curtis jumps. I mean, imagine. You're not an animal handler, not a vet, not Roy's parent or partner, just one of many stagehands. And you're jumping into a large dark box with a wild 400-pound tiger, a lot of blood, no weapon, no exit. For some very long seconds, Curtis is pulling on Roy, trying against all common sense to pry him away from the tiger's jaw. Then an animal handler joins him with a fire extinguisher and sprays Manticore. The cat lets go. The beat-by-beat account of the whole thing, up to the arrival of the paramedics, is too harrowing to recount. You can listen to Curtis telling it in his own words on Wild Things, the podcast by journalist Stephen Leckard that some of this episode was based on. At last, they stabilize Roy enough to take him to the hospital. He still talks.
He pleads, "Do not hurt the cat." Siegfried, shuffling like a zombie, follows the ambulance. Within minutes, the news is all over the local radio. Listening to the radio is Penn Jillette, the talking half of the Penn and Teller act. Penn is a magician's magician, gifted and erudite, known for crafting incredibly elaborate illusions and sometimes even explaining them, because nobody can crack them. Before Penn realizes what he's doing or why, he's driving straight to the University Medical Center. There he is on the parking lot, his double bass physique at 6'7", towering over a growing crowd of fans and staff members and paparazzi when someone grabs him by the arm and takes him inside. Inside the hospital, Siegfried is barely able to wave at the crowd, too shaken to speak in complete sentences. Bernie Human asks Penn if he would like to speak to the press, on behalf of the duo. This takes Penn by surprise. He says, "I used to make jokes about them." And yes, he did. Good ones, too. You wouldn't like to be at the receiving end of Penn's jokes. The man has a sharp wit and a very low bullshit threshold. He made fun of the sequin capes, of the tigers, of the pompous good versus evil shtick with the evil queen and the hydraulic dragon. But he never made fun of the magic. He knew that was solid. And he never, ever hinted at calling them gay. In that, he was one of the very few. Talk about a pink elephant in the room. Why hasn't this been mentioned sooner? It's in black and white on their Wikipedia page, romantically involved. And anyway, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? What with the costumes and the hair and the open shirts and the sharing of the house and the wild parties, I mean, how flamboyant do you have to be? I don't know. Maybe the fact that they consistently refused to address the point themselves should have been enough of a clue. Maybe the fact that the media were obsessed with their sex lives tells more about the media and their audience than about the duo. But it was the low-hanging fruit, and everyone rushed for a bite.
We are actually more than brothers.
Are you lovers?
We are. I love Roy like my brother.
I love Roy like a brother.
Why didn't it stop there? And it didn't. The jokes did a poor job of masking this hate, the disgust, and the moral superiority. Siegfried and Roy were recurring characters on Saturday Night Live, and even there, for one funny and genuinely respectful skit featuring the Scottish actor and gay activist Alan Cumming as Siegfried, there were many, many more questionable takes. When Annette Tappert arrived in Vegas in the fall of 1990 to write the duo's authorized biography, all she knew of them were the SNL skits. During the year and a half she interviewed them, she pressed the question. It was off limits. On that, they never budged. At several points in the book, they mention having girlfriends. Make of that what you will.
But you have to remember, the duo came to the forefront in the 1980s, the era of AIDS, a time when gay men were dying atrocious deaths, when the government told them it was their fault, when their religion told them it served them right, a time when love killed. One of Siegfried and Roy's biggest assets is that they were a family show. At the time, taking your kids to see an openly gay couple was unthinkable. It likely would have finished them in a Vegas minute.
But the tighter the lid, the wilder the speculation. Regularly when they went on breaks, you'd find somebody with a microphone to claim they had HIV. There was even a rumor that Roy had died of AIDS in 1988 during the building of the Mirage, and had been replaced by Roy's younger cousin after some cosmetic surgery. The actress Shirley MacLaine endorsed that rumor in an interview to the Las Vegas Review-Journal in 1990, saying she knew someone who'd attended the funeral. The newspaper ended up publishing a denial from the Clark County Coroner's Office that they had ever issued a death certificate for Roy. Roy did not die in 1988. More surprisingly, he didn't die in 2003 either, when Manticore's jaws exerted 1,000 pounds of pressure per square inch on his neck. Dr. Jay Coates, at the time vice chairman of the Trauma Center, says Roy flatlined. Coates inserted an airway, started the heart again. Two big puncture wounds below the hairline, and one in the neck, had broken his cervical vertebrae and crushed the carotid artery. Roy's brain started swelling, so the medical team removed a piece of skull. Roy survived the ordeal, but from then on, he faces years in a wheelchair with drips and daily care, months before he can speak again. The human being is still there, but the flamboyant optimist, the dashing showman, who flew with tigers, is gone. You'd think that in light of the tragedy, the haters and the conspiracy theorists would have managed to locate a grain of decency. You'd be wrong. It's worse. The vitriol is unfathomable, except now, it doesn't stop at calumny. Cole Ford used to be a place kicker in the NFL. From 1995 to 97, he played for the Oakland Raiders. Then it all stopped one day, and now Cole Ford is living in his van. In 2004, he drives to Las Vegas and sues the Mirage. Cole demands $5 million in damages. He accuses the casino of profiting off sports betting, which he equates to exploiting athletes. The case is dismissed. For Cole, that may have been the last straw. On September 21st, 2004, he drives to the Jungle Palace, Siegfried and Roy's primary home on Valley Drive. Vegas ruined him, so he's going to ruin the people who most symbolize Vegas. From the van's window, he fires 6 shots at the gates. There are more than Siegfried and Roy in there. There are gardeners, animal handlers, paramedics, all kinds of permanent employees. Not to mention, possibly up to 63 tigers. It's a miracle no one gets hit. Nevertheless, it's a hate crime in broad daylight. Thanks to a gardener parked nearby who got the van's plate, the police track Cole to Tucson, Arizona, where he grew up, and where he proceeded to embark on a shooting spree, mercifully hurting no one. Arrested, Cole declares that he feels threatened by the magicians who are trying to trap him energetically, that they are an extension of his parents. He's seen photos, he says, voodoo dolls and bondage. He says he knows they're having sex with their animals. Cole Ford is ruled mentally incompetent to stand trial. He spends time in a psychiatric facility where he makes a spectacular recovery. At his trial, he insists on pleading guilty. Yet his shots are only the first bullets Siegfried and Roy would have to dodge. Stars shouldn't get old, if only because when they do, it gives time to look into their dirty laundry. In September of 2010, one of Roy's personal assistants files a lawsuit. A German national, identified as Oliver, he claims to have been sexually assaulted by both Siegfried and Roy from January to April of that year. Allegedly, when told to stop, Siegfried stopped. Roy didn't. CCTV footage reportedly shows unrequited gestures. The judge throws the video out on a technicality. Oliver refiles his sexual assault and battery claims in state court. He is joined by 2 other assistants who work for Roy and another who works for Siegfried. The case drags on for 2 years. In 2014, the court rejects the case and, quote, misplaces the video. When you've been that successful for that long, when you've done so much to change the face of a city, it only makes sense that you should have steadfast political allies. 1 month after Roy's accident, the U.S. House of Representatives passes a resolution, quote, honoring the achievements of Siegfried and Roy, recognizing the impact of their efforts on the conservation of endangered species both domestically and worldwide, and wishing Roy Horn a full and speedy recovery. The resolution lists their awards and, quote, truly wondrous achievements, both in showbiz and in animal breeding. It also mentions their, quote, numerous generous contributions to the community of Las Vegas and local charitable organizations, including Opportunity Village, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Canine Unit, the Nevada Cancer Institute, Clark County School District, the Lunch with a Leader program, Golden Rainbow, and the USO Benefit Show. This goes a long way in explaining how the duo could, for literal decades, introduce wild animals on stage with the audience sitting a few feet away. To perform with animals on stage, you need a USDA animal license. It's renewed annually, pending compliance to the Animal Welfare Act. Among other stipulations, the act states that there has to be a barrier separating the animals from the audience at all times, something Siegfried and Roy have never had. So, in early 2003, a USDA officer attends the show. In a memo, he notes 3 instances where animals are on stage and, quote, not restrained in any manner, not even a leash or a hand holding a collar. In April of that year, 6 months before the accident, a USDA memo requests that Siegfried and Roy erect a physical barrier. Took them 30 years. And now PETA gets involved. They have a lot on their food bowl. There's the secret garden, the enclosure at the Mirage comprising the tiger habitat, the menagerie, and a pool with dolphins. There's Little Bavaria, Siegfried and Roy's 100-acre property in North Vegas where they moved to after the accident. And of course, there's the show. The times are a-changing, and voices protesting the use of animals on stage are getting insistent. Animal rights activist associations Born Free USA and the World Society for the Protection of Animals file a complaint against the Mirage. PETA trashes the animals' living conditions, how they're trained for the acts, how a brightly lit stage with a massive sound system has nothing in common with their natural habitat, which for tigers can cover 100 square miles. They note the staggering overpopulation of tigers in captivity, against an estimated 5,500 tigers in the wild, according to the World Wildlife Foundation, there are 5,000 in captivity in the U.S. alone. 3 days after Roy's accident, PETA faxes a letter to his hospital room, urging the duo to retire the animals. They don't. In February of 2009, once Roy is in better shape, they stage their goodbyes at the Bellagio. Fundraiser tickets reach $1,500. The show, once again, features a white tiger. Roy dies on May 8, 2020, from COVID. Siegfried, who cared for him daily after the accident, follows Roy 5 months later from pancreatic cancer. Not long after, an alley leading to the Mirage is renamed Siegfried and Roy Drive. Las Vegas mourns, briefly. Then, it keeps morphing. In 2021, the Seminole Tribe of Florida purchases the Mirage for $1 billion. The tribe already owns the Hard Rock Cafe franchise. The move is a historic moment, marking the first Native American-owned casino operation on the Las Vegas Strip. The planned transformation includes the construction of a guitar-shaped hotel tower and the coming of a new era, an era without animals in cages. The Secret Garden at the Mirage closes its doors on September 25th, 2022. Just the day before, K2, an 11-year-old male bottlenose dolphin, passed away. He was the third dolphin to die at the Secret Garden that year, after Maverick, age 19, and Bella, 13. People had started dubbing the dolphin attraction the Death Pool. On January 25, 2025, the 17-foot-tall bronze Siegfried and Roy statue on the Strip is removed from its longtime home at the Mirage. The sculpture had greeted visitors since its dedication by Steve Wynn in 1993. It has been relocated to the Neon Museum, also in Vegas. In the fall of 2025, production starts on an 8-hour series based on the Wild Things podcast for Apple TV. It will star Jude Law as Siegfried and Andrew Garfield as Roy. Animal rights groups have written to the producers, urging them to use technology instead of actual wild animals. At the time of writing, they're still waiting for an answer. Manticore, the white tiger who mauled Roy, was not put to sleep after the accident. Bernie Human and Siegfried went into damage control mode. They spun a rather ridiculous story. You see, Manticore was actually trying to protect Roy after he'd suffered a heart attack on stage. Quite a slap in the face to Curtis Rao, the stagehand who'd risked his life jumping into the substitution box. But it was in keeping with the fib Siegfried and Roy had always told, that no harm could come from their tigers. Obviously, it's a helpful yarn to spin when there's nothing to protect your paying audience from a pride of wild animals each sporting 500 pounds of muscle, the temper of a mob boss, and jaws like a power hammer. Out of love, perhaps, out of sheer blindness, maybe, out of PR savviness for sure, they kept denying the quote-unquote wild side of their cats. Supposedly, Manticore loved Roy like his mother, after Roy helped in the difficult delivery at the Guadalajara Zoo in Mexico. In truth, he wasn't even there. He'd sent to the zoo a trusted vet, the doctor who'd cared for Michael Jackson's baby giraffes. Supposedly, there had never been a single accident with the animals in all their years on stage. Well, remember when Siegfried himself was mauled by Leo the lion? And at least two people, a stagehand who was building an ice cave for the tigers at the Jungle Palace in 1985, and a 10-year-old child from a family of performers backstage in 1976, were violently attacked and suffered life-threatening injuries. The kid owed his life to the fact that the leopard had been declawed. Siegfried and Roy would swear on their teddy bears that they never declawed their cats. Manticore lived in the menagerie at the Mirage until he passed away in 2014. Cats require routine, so he regularly went on exhibit. But to protect him from the public and the press, he appeared under a different name. Manticore was the name Roy chose for him. The manticore is a mythological creature. Similar to the Egyptian sphinx, it has the body of a lion, a scorpion's tail, and a man's face harboring three rows of sharp teeth. It belongs to the myths and legends of ancient Persia. The name translates as man-eater. Were you watching closely?
save the blame. Walk away. You want to.